All right, great. So thank you, Mohammed, for the introduction as well as the invite to present my work in presence of mathematicians, I suppose. I've rarely done that. I've presented my work in front of engineers quite a bit, and but I was kind of encouraged to see a lot of biology being discussed in the morning sessions. So what I did was shift my talk a little bit to kind of bridge what has been addressed in the morning. So I talk a little bit about some of the stem cell work that we have done, and then bridge it with nanotechnology, some of the things that are being done in my lab. So as I said, as was discussed in the morning, there's a lot of emphasis on that we need to think about cancer in a different way. There's also an emphasis on developing new drugs, which are basically targeting the dividing cancer cell. So this fits in very well with the prevalent hypothesis, in the sense that if you ask anybody, they would say cancer is a bunch of rapidly dividing or dysregulated dividing cells. And the idea is to cure cancer by targeting this rapidly dividing cells. So most of the drug therapies that have been developed till today have targeted this rapidly or proliferating cells, and as a result, you actually end up targeting everything that is rapidly dividing in our bodies, like, for example, the gut or the hair cells, and you have all these side effects. So, but if you look at the cross-section of a tumor, this is a electron micrograph of a cross-section of a tumor. What you see is these are the tumor cells. You see a lot of these surrounding structures, which is the microenvironment. You have blood vessels. You can actually see a red blood cell in there. So this is basically what a tumor is. And if you just focus on one small part of the whole thing, you're missing out on the global picture. And that is the reason, that is the way we have started thinking about in our lab. So the question is, what is the role played by the vasculature? What are the roles played by the sugars? So when I was thinking about, or when I was listening to the talks in the morning, I decided that I should switch the orientation of the talk a little bit and talk about how we think in the lab. So what we are thinking about is that cancer is an aberrant interplay of cells undergoing dysregulated proliferation. It also includes the stroma, which comprises of the matrix, and supporting cells, including the new vasculature. So in fact, like, these are concepts that exist. A lot of groups have been working on the new vasculature or inhibiting angiogenesis. There is a bunch of people working on the stroma. And then obviously, the main focus is still targeting the rapidly dividing cancer cells. So the question is, how do we actually integrate all of them? And then the later part of my talk would be to figure out what are the platforms that exist that can actually target these multiple compartments at the same time. So I started off looking at angiogenesis from cancer perspective quite some time back, and it's a very interesting area to start off. I mean, specifically given the current funding scenario, it's a very attractive field. Reason being that if you look at normal angiogenesis, it doesn't happen in our body. So the moment you're born, after that, you really don't have angiogenesis. Except in certain conditions, for example, if you have a cut and or tissue needs to regenerate, you have angiogenesis happening. But the unique aspect of those vessels are they actually regress after the whole process has taken place. It doesn't actually keep continuing. Or in the reproductive cycle, again, like a cyclical process, you have the vascularization come in the uterine bed, and then it kind of regresses after a few weeks. So This is physiological angiogenesis. On the other hand, if you have aberrant angiogenesis or excess angiogenesis, it underlies cancer progression, other diseases like arthritis and retinopathy and asthma. So as a result, I mean, in this case, the focus of the field has been to inhibit angiogenesis, and there have been some challenges. There has been a huge milestone of progress in this field, but there have been challenges. And the other side is that if you have impaired angiogenesis, for example, in diabetics, you would have chronic wounds or diabetic sores. You also can have coronary artery diseases. So as a result, this area basically becomes very interesting because you can pretty much position your grants in multiple different areas. So in current funding scenario, that's a huge attractive attraction. So the traditional concept of angiogenesis has been that the formation of new blood vessels from existing vascular bed. So that's been the traditional meaning or definition of angiogenesis. But there's a new concept which has come up, which is basically the vasculogenesis, or the development of blood vessels from de novo, from precursor cells. And this is a pretty interesting picture from David Scadden's group. I think Rakesh Jain was also involved in this study, where they actually showed that endothelial progenitor cells can actually give rise to these vascular structures, which are embedded within the existing vasculature over a period of time, and they can maintain circulation for over like 150 days. That's a dramatic shift away from just angiogenesis. So now you have a different set of cells which can actually give rise to new vasculature. So just targeting the existing vasculature or the endothelial cells are not going to be enough. You basically have to target these precursor cells also if you want to shut down tumor angiogenesis. So these are some of the concepts that have evolved. So some of the questions that we started thinking about is, if vasculogenesis is also happening in adults, then we need to understand how blood vessels are formed. We have to go back to the basics. So what we did was, these are the questions that we asked, and I talk about in my talk. So how are blood vessels formed? What is the role of the matrix in this process? So you have to keep in mind that the image that you saw, a lot of it was actually the matrix. In the talk on the stem cell biology today, a lot of emphasis was paid on how the matrix can actually influence the process, and that was the hypothesis. What I do today is, so this is data that has not been published. It's in the review process right now, and I'll show you data that shows that matrix actually plays a role in differentiation of stem cells into vasculature. And the newer paradigm is, can we actually target both the stroma and the parenchyma? The stroma is the supporting infrastructure that exists in the tumor, and the parenchyma are the dividing cancer cells. So this has been the traditional domain where most cancer biologists have looked at. Now we need to target both, and I'd talk about what we have done or in terms of development of platforms for targeting both compartments of cancer. So the biggest challenge in matrix biology has been the composition of the matter. Okay. So what happens is, this is basically, for example, a cartoon showing a cell. The cell has these protein cores connected to which are these sugar chains. And it has been extremely difficult to develop tools to sequence the sugars. And the reason is that these are predominantly heparan sulfates. These are made up of these disaccharide units and can extend up to about 100 disaccharide units long. So each disaccharide unit has these sites which can, sorry, so this disaccharide, this compartment can be a glucuronic acid or an iduronic acid. The X's can be sulfated or non-sulfated, and the Y can be sulfated or acetylated. So with these kind of permutation combinations, you can pretty much imagine the number of variables that you'd end up with. And the problem was that we didn't have the tools to sequence them. So for example, like this can itself give rise to about 32 building blocks in terms of combinations. So what happens is, instead of like having 4 for DNA or 20 for amino acids, you have so much of variability. And as a result, like people stopped looking at it. So we started looking at this by adapting technologies that were being developed to sequence heparin, and we adapted it into cell biology. And so before I talk into sequencing, so the reason that there is so much of variability in the sugars or the microenvironment or the matrix is because these sugars are synthesized through sequence of steps or synthetic steps that are enzymatically driven. They're not template driven. you basically have what you have on the cell surface. You can't amplify the material. So what you have to develop is extremely sensitive sequencing technologies or tools to come up with structures. So, and these are some of the enzymes, and one of the enzymes I would actually talk about in greater details. So you start off with basic building blocks, which are added by transferases, and then you get these disaccharide units. This deacetylase N-sulfotransferase removes NAC or acetyl group as the sulfate group, and then you have the epimerases, which actually removes a glucuronic acid to an adrenergic acid, and then you have these sulfotransferases that add these regions of sulfation. It's extremely important because whatever a cell sees or ligands that are presented to the receptor, they actually first bind to these sequences, and this extreme specificity in terms of what these ligands would bind to. So if you modify these sequences, then you actually stop certain processes. So these are the ways that we evolve to sequence the sugars. What we do is we do proteolytic digestion, isolate the protein core, and then we use a sequence of enzymes to chop the sugars off. And they're separated, they're extremely charged, so they can be separated by capillary electrophoresis. Then they can be passed into a mass spec, a CEMS model. And then you can come up with computational fitting to start off with, to come up with best predictors of what you started off with. So that's the way we have evolved in terms of looking at the sugars in the matrix. So the next aspect was to figure out what is the role of these. We have the tools to sequence the sugars. We wanted to figure out how the sugars are playing a role in angiogenesis or vasculogenesis in this case. I won't talk about the angiogenesis compartment today. So what we did was, so the easiest way of looking at vasculogenesis in an in vitro system is to look at how blood vessels are formed in an embryo body. So if you take embryonic stem cells and you grow them in a hanging drop culture or in a petri dish, which is extremely low adherent, they form these round embryoid structures. These are pretty much mimicking a small embryo. So what you've seen is over a period of 15 days, they actually start beating. So, and they go through exactly the same sequences of development up to certain stage that normal embryo would go through. So these are murine embryonic stem cells on day 3. And this is a marker for endothelial cells. So you can see on day 3, there's hardly any cell that has differentiated into a blood vessel or an endothelial cell. With time, you can see that the signal for the vasculature is going up. And this is mimicked by looking at real-time PCR or the mRNA signal. So if you look at this, OCT4 is a marker for stemness or stem cell, embryonic stem cell. So with time, they're going down. And these are markers for endothelial cells, so with time they were going up. This pretty much took us about 2 years to establish, because a lot of groups had actually done studies on embryonic stem cells and the differentiation into endothelial cells. But and we tried replicating those things. It worked fine, and then we introduced what is called an isotype control in our study. Okay, so looked at non-specific bindings of the antibodies. And we found that what we are getting at 24-25% yield in terms of endothelial cells, they actually dropped to 2%. So the antibodies had non-specific binding. So we pretty much had to go back and then develop a protocol where we can actually create hypoxia and then starve the cells over a certain period of time to get about 20% cells which are differentiated into endothelial cells. So this took us the biggest amount of time. So once we had this differentiation protocol sorted out, what we did was, yeah. These are R129 cell lines, embryonic stem cell cell lines. So what we did was, so the next step was to figure out what is happening to the matrix. So we looked at the first enzyme in the synthetic process, the deacetylase N-sulfotransferase. And if you notice, as the cells are differentiating towards an endothelial lineage, this enzyme actually goes up at the level of the mRNA. This is real-time PCR data. When you look at the protein, there's actually an upregulation of the protein over time. This is day 3 and day 7. So one of the things that we did was, even though we have done up to day 10 in terms of differentiation, in subsequent studies, we have kept it up to day 7. And the reason being, in this model, beyond day 7, you have angiogenesis happening. So vascular structures coming from existing vascular beds. So we wanted to keep the vascular genesis component separate from the angiogenesis compartment. And then we sequenced the sugars. We took the sugars from these two time points. And we looked at what is happening to the cell surface sugars. So if you look at the CE profile, this is day 7. You have trisulfated sugars, disulfated sugars, monosulfated sugars. These are like highly sulfated residues, which are coming up within day 7, which are completely absent in day 3. So as the stem cells are differentiating, you actually get more and more sulfated sugars. And we have continued this process over a period of time. So you might argue that this might be a cause or a result of differentiation, or is it inducing differentiation? So to answer that question, what we did was we treated the cells with sodium chlorate. So what sodium chlorate does is it prevents sulfation of the sugar. So the sugars are completely formed, but the nascent chains are there, but there's no sulfation. And the reason being, sodium chlorate basically prevents an enzyme that provides the sulfur groups. So in this case, now you have these building blocks. What you'd end up with is all these X and Y are completely non-sulfated. So this is, for example, a wild-type emerald body sugar profile on day 7. You can see the trisulfate, disulfate peaks. When you treat them with sodium chloride, it's completely gone. And what we found is, with increasing concentration of sodium chloride, you can prevent the differentiation into endothelial cells. So these are monoequilibrium factor staining, which is the marker for endothelial cells. But the intriguing bit was, in this condition, if you throw in heparin, which is kind of a mimic of what happens in of the structure of microenvironment, it starts coming back. So this is a highly sulfated sugar. So what I'm trying to do to prove here is that the microenvironment has a critical role to play in the differentiation process of how blood vessels are formed. And this becomes extremely critical to understand, to develop therapeutics later, which targets all these compartments. So these are further experiments that we have done, in sense that, so this was differentiation and the effect of different treatments on differentiation of stem cells into vascular structures. So in this case, you can see from day 3 to day 7, there's a significant increase in the marker. When you treat them with sodium chloride, it's completely inhibited. What we did next was to treat these cells or embryonic bodies with enzymes that depolymerize the sugar. So you can actually chop them up into small bits. And you can see that they are actually blocked. So you can block differentiation by this process. So the next step was to see whether this actually translates into in vivo models. So what we did was we took a developing zebrafish model. This is a very interesting model to study because you can actually do them in small 96-well plates, so it's high throughput. And the second thing is the embryos are completely transparent, so you can see development happening. You can monitor their blood flow or blood vessels. So we took this is a wild-type zebrafish embryo. We knocked out this enzyme, which is getting upregulated in differentiation process, or during vascular genesis. And what happens is, you can see the tail has regressed. And this is what happens. So this is a wild-type sugar. When you knock it out using a morphal, you can see that the sugars are pretty much gone. And the interesting bit is, now in this case, if you inject back heparin, which is again like a surrogate for the matrix, sulfated matrix. So in this case, this is the wild-type fish. This is the knockdown fish. When you inject back heparin, you get recovery of function, which proves that the sugars are important in the whole process, or the microenvironment is important in the process of development of vasculature. So the next step was to further characterize the phenotype. So what we did was we took these GFP positive cells. So these are fish which are expressing GFP, a green fluorescent protein, under endothelial promoter. So in this case, all these structures are vascular structures. So in the knockdown fish or the morpholino knockdown fish, you can see it's completely aberrant. And the next thing that we did was we injected dextrin coupled to rhodamine, which gives a red dye, red color, into the system to see how whether these are functional or not. So you can see that rhodamine in all these vascular structures. So there's blood flow. It's completely absent in this system. So when you knock down the sugars, you're completely disrupting the vasculature. So yes. I'm sorry? Yes. So is disrupted. Yes. And that depends upon different types of isoforms of NDST. So they're expressed in different parts of the body. So and this is what we found. So in a normal wild type fish, the blood kind of flows up to the tail, comes back. In the knockdown, there's actually a shunting. So it doesn't come till the tip, but shunts through this process. And what I can do is I can actually show you a movie, which is pretty dramatic, actually. Okay. Hopefully it'll play. All right. So this is the tail, and what we did was we injected the red dye in the tail into the developing fish. This is a wild type fish, and you can see the blood is actually flowing to the tip and coming back. Okay. Now, if I compare that with the one in which I've knocked down the sugars or the enzyme that synthesizes the sugar, you can see the shunt. So here, it's coming back. And what has happened is you have a pool of blood cells that are now just stagnating there. And over a period of time, because there's no blood flow, the tail regresses. So that's the dramatic phenotype that you actually see if you knock down the sugars. And, right. So the next step that we did was to try figure out what is happening. How does the sugar that is on the cell surface affect what is happening inside the cell? And so we did microarray studies, and this is basically the genes that are expressed in the wild type versus that are expressed in the knockdown. So there's completely a switch in the number of genes or the types of genes that are upregulated. So if you look at, and these are three different time points that we have monitored, and that's an interesting challenge because, and that's something that we are trying to kind of model, because now we can actually follow the genes that are expressed over time, and that's a pretty challenging mathematical question to answer. And so this is 6-somite stage, which is one of the critical steps in developing the vasculature. Again, like this is 20-somite stage and 24-somite stage. So you can see that the number of genes. This was between wild type and the morphin. This was 67. This is a critical period when the mesoderm basically changes into main vascular structures. You can see 617 transcripts are dysregulated, and then it comes down to 119. And if you classify them according to functions, you can see that they are implicated in cell signaling, transcription factors, cell proliferation and differentiation, protein stability, apoptosis, and cell matrix. And based on these things, then we developed a model of how these are connected to each other, and these are potentially pathways that are implicated in this process. And since we have done this study, it has been shown that one of this is absolutely critical in angiogenic process. So these now are very interesting targets to study or perturb to block or vasculogenesis that can happen in the tumor. So what I'm trying to do here is I just talked about basic biology work that is happening in the lab, where we are trying to see how the matrix fits in with or has a biological role in the process of vasculogenesis or angiogenesis, which is critical in tumor biology. Now, switching gears to the more applied side, and which is what I thought I'd initially talk about, is can we now come up with therapies that can target both compartments? Like, can you target angiogenesis as well as the tumor simultaneously? Now, if you look at how a tumor angiogenesis proceeds, so you have these tumors, the tumor becomes hypoxic at a certain point of time or size because it has no vascular structures. So the hypoxic core now starts secreting growth factors, which attracts the vasculature. And so the traditional therapy is that you shut this vasculature down using antiangiogenics. The problem is that you revert back the tumor to its hypoxic state. And there have been a couple of papers that have now shown that that this actually becomes dormant, and once you take the antiangiogenic therapy off, you start selecting for cells that are resistant to hypoxia. Once you take this therapy off, the tumor can come back. And this is something that we also found that in these conditions, the tumor can become more metastatic, or you start selecting for cells that are more metastatic in nature. So the idea is that now you need to combine antiangiogenic therapies with cytotoxic therapy. So this combination therapy comes in picture. But the problem is, in this case, if you give a cytotoxic therapy now, and there's no vascular structure to take it inside, then it's not going to work. Also, the picture is basically, so we cultured breast cancer cells to confluence, and then we injured them. And they were cultured in normal conditions for 24 hours or under hypoxic stress. So under hypoxic stress, you can see the cells are moving much more aggressively. And this has been shown to be mediated through MET receptor upregulation through hypoxia-inducible factor pathway. So this, so that's the reason why you need to kill the remaining cells. You can't just use hypoxia to kill all the cells. So that's when we started looking at the solutions. So how do you get drugs into the tumor after vascular shutdown? So there is a hypothesis. So Rakesh Jain has done an extensive amount of work showing that if you give antiangiogenic therapies, then you actually load more drugs into the tumor. And a concept called normalization. But the problem is that you have to give these therapies repeatedly. And with subsequent therapies, you start shrinking the number of vessels that can actually deliver drugs. So we started looking at how do you deliver drugs when there's no vasculature in the tumor. And we resorted to nanotechnology. So the thing is that, like, it's a lot of people say that it's the whole field is a hype. And but the thing is that it actually started way back in 1960s. So this was... Feynman basically gave this talk showing how you can actually play around with structures atom by atom. So what we did was we designed a hybrid nanoparticle that could deploy two drugs. So what we did was we took these polymers. In this case, this was PLGA. One of the critical things that we kept in mind was that every bit of ingredient that went into designing this thing should be approved by FDA so that we could quickly translate it into clinics. So this was approved for use in human beings. It's a biodegradable polymer. We conjugated this drug called doxorubicin. It's a highly cytotoxic drug, causes cardiac complications on the side effects. And we found that even after conjugation, it's still active. So this is pre-dox, this is after conjugation. And with time, as the doxorubicin comes out, these two lines merge. We made nanoparticles out of these structures. We took these nanoparticles and we coated them in this lipid layer where we put in another drug. And this drug shuts down vasculature. It's called a vascular targeting agent. So when you had these structures, these are about 120 nanometers in size. When you coated them with lipids, the size went up to about 180 to 200 nanometers. What is interesting is tumor vasculature is extremely leaky. So they have pores as big as 400 to about 800 nanometers in size. And if you surface modify the lipids with pegylation or polyethylene glycol, then it becomes immune. It becomes stealth. It can't be detected by your immune system. So these particles then circulate in the body over extended periods of time, and the only way they can come out is through these leaky vasculatures in the tumor, because they can't go anywhere else. They can't be cleared by the immune system. So what happens is, because the lipid layer can disrupt early, you get a rapid release of the vascular targeting agent first. And this we have monitored up to 15 days, so you get a sustained release which keeps going up over a period of time. So what happens is, these particles, you inject it into the vein, it circulates in the body, it goes into the tumor, releases this drug. Its circulation time is about 50 hours. Once inside the tumor, if this drug is released, the vessels are shut down, and that's when the tumor becomes hypoxic. And as the tumor becomes hypoxic, it starts secreting enzymes called esterases, which cleaves this drug off. And that's when the next drug comes out. So it's a very simple concept of using mechanisms that the tumor deploys to survive to trigger the release of the next drug or the cytotoxic drug. So as a result, now even after shutdown of the vasculature, you can get cytotoxic drug in the tumor. So these were some of the in vitro systems that we had to deploy to screen the product. So that's basically a three-dimensional co-culture system. So now you have blood vessels growing on a three-dimensional matrix, which is about 60 micrometer thick, and you have tumor cells growing around the vasculature. So if you merge these two images, this is how it looks like. So the yellow cells that you see are tumor cells growing on a matrix. So you're mimicking the tumor environment. You have blood vessels or tube-like structures growing around these tumor cells. You treat them with the vascular targeting agent. You can see the red cells are completely gone. You treat them with the anti-cancer drug. You can see the yellow cells are completely gone. You combine the two. You can see at 12 hours, because this drug is coming out faster, you can see the red cells are dying, and within 30 hours, you can see both of them are dead. So you have the sequential release of the two drugs, which mimics the tumor environment. So what we have is a platform that can target both the stroma as well as the parenchyma using nanotechnology. It's very difficult to otherwise target both compartments at the same time. So we translated this into animal models. So in this case, this is a melanoma, and this is mouse treated with just vehicle, or just the anti-angiogenic drug, or just the anti-cancer drug. So you can see that they're still both the drugs are working. When you combine the two, it's actually less effective. And subsequent to our paper, there have been a couple of groups which have published that the number of nanoparticles that you can load in a tumor is limited. So you can't go beyond a certain amount. So if you have two different carriers for two different drugs, then you're actually getting less amount of drug in the tumor. And if you have a spatiotemporal release, so one drug coming out after another, then you can, using the system that we have built, you shrink the tumor dramatically as compared to both the drugs coming out together. So this is a simple formulation with both drugs coming out at the same time. So this was melanoma. It didn't actually translate that dramatically to lung cancer. And the reason is, the drug of choice for lung cancer is not doxorubicin, it's cisplatin. So depending upon different cancer types, you have to basically play around with your chemistry and your cytotoxic agents. And what we also found is, because these formulations are entrapped, so the cytotoxic drug is now shut down or locked down within the tumor, it can't come out, and it's released over a period of time, you actually reduce cytotoxicity to some extent, and this is WBC counts. We also measured the amount of distribution of these particles in different tissues with time. So you can actually see with time, it's actually going down in spleen, slightly going down in lungs, which are immune systems of the body. It starts accumulating in the tumor. It grows down dramatically in the plasma. So they're preferentially homing into tumor and are avoiding the immune system. So that's a different issue. That's multiple drug resistance, basically, MDR and upregulation of T glycoproteins. So those would be difficult to treat with the drugs here. So that's a completely different area. What we're trying to do is sequentially target the vessels followed by the cancer cells. And not, we still don't have the models to block MDR or drug efflux. And just to show that we actually get leakage of these particles into out of tumor vasculature. So what we did was we designed a particle, except that in the core, we replaced them with quantum dots. So now you can see that's a lipid core, and you have quantum dots inside. When you inject that into the animals, you can see that they're restricted within. So this is the blood vessel in a liver. You can see that the kind of overlay. But in the tumor, that's the vasculature. You can see a lot of signature outside the vasculature. So they're leaking out of the tumor vessels. This is a confocal image of the whole thing. So the next thing that we did was to figure out what are the mechanisms of action for the increased efficacy. So what happens is, these green signals are from blood vessels in a cross section of a tumor. So that is treated with vehicle. When you shut it down with camizestatin or the vascular targeting agent, you can see the green signal is gone. Just this drug, the cytotoxic agent, has absolutely zero effect on the vasculature. And there have been groups which have shown that doxorubicin is anti-angiogenic, but we haven't been able to replicate that. When you combine the two, you can see that the presence of the vascular targeting agent has removed the vasculature, as also in these groups. What is intriguing is, in the camizestatin treated group or the vascular targeting agent treated group, you see a lot of hypoxia or the green signal as compared to doxorubicin treated group or the cytotoxic treated group. And the problem is, with hypoxia, you get upregulation of growth factors. So in this formulation of the hybrid nanoparticle, you see a lot of hypoxia, but you also see a lot of red cells. And the red signal is basically cells that are undergoing apoptosis or cell death, because of the presence of the cytotoxic agent. So what happens is, even the hypoxia goes up, and you do have a feedback loop in terms of growth factor, because of increased apoptosis here or there, you actually shut down or reduce the tumor growth. So that's the advantage of targeting both compartments at the same time. Just targeting one couldn't have resulted in this efficacy. So that's the reason why we are so excited about targeting, like keeping the broad picture in mind and just not focus on one single compartment of a tumor. So to conclude, we basically think that like spatiotemporal targeting of both the tumor stroma as well as the parenchyma results in the increased anti-tumor efficacy, and that is only enabled through using this platform. But it's also very important to understand the global scenario. Now that we have all these pathways worked out in terms of what leads to differentiation of stem cells or the role of matrix in stem cell differentiation, we need to have a global picture. We need to figure out the key points that can be blocked to basically have a broad shutdown of tumor progression. And it's very important to basically think out of the box. And the reason is captured in this image. So this is typically what people have been doing till now. So this is, we're trying to discover a solution for cancer. So what we do is we take out so in this case, this car is your discovery or solution for cancer. This is the traditional modes of looking at research. So the car is coming out, it crashes, okay? So that's the problem. So what happens is, what you do is you come back with a bigger gun to solve the problem. It's the same strategy, but now you've expanded your platform. You have a bigger drug development platform. So now everything is coming out, okay? And it crashes. So that is the reason why developing a drug today costs $1.5 billion. I mean, this was addressed in a talk before lunch. So we basically need to look at cancer therapy in a completely different way, and that's what we're trying to do. So to acknowledge, these are postdocs who have worked with me and my graduate students, and I have funding from Coulter Foundation, Department of Defense, American Heart Association, and Marie Kiash Foundation. So.